You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting on KPCW, Park City, Utah. Good morning. You are listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. My name is Allison Kulo, and I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Allison, and good morning to Park City.
Absolutely. Well, we've got a great show coming up today. Doug, do you want to give our listeners just an overview of what we've got going on?
Sure. This morning, we're going to be speaking with e-commerce expert Jason Boyce, who's going to join Mountain Money to talk about Amazon, the cost of Amazon success and fears over competition and consumer choice, personal privacy, pricing power, and public services that are relying on Amazon. And then our second guest is Eric Joachim Taylor, who is the author of The Interaction Field, the revolutionary new way to create shared value for business, customers, and society. And his book explores a new way for companies to go beyond platforms and digital ecosystems, a model that he believes solves the immediate challenges of people today and also some of the major social and economic changes that we're going to see in the future. And then we're going to end the hour with a local celebrity. We're going to be speaking with Seth Adams with the River Horse Group about their new eatery in Prospector Square called The Salt Box. All this and more on Mountain Money. Please stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. America's big tech companies provide valuable products, but also wield enormous power over our digital lives. Following strong sales on Black Friday and Cyber Monday, it's clear that Amazon is more powerful than ever before. Many look at Amazon as a shopping and marketing platform, but it is more than that. Amazon is a delivery network, a payment service, a credit lender, a book publisher, a film producer, a fashion designer, a hardware manufacturer, a digital security company, and an online advertising giant. Nearly half of all e-commerce goes through Amazon, and 18% of the world's most popular websites are hosted or run on Amazon Web Services. There continues to be greater fears about the cost of Amazon success, fears over competition and consumer choice, personal privacy, pricing power, and public services reliant on Amazon.
E-commerce expert Jason Boyce is our guest. He is a nationally recognized authority on Amazon, and he feels he is exposing the truth about the tech giant that annihilates anyone in its path. And he's the author of a book called The Amazon Jungle, The Truth About Amazon, the Seller's Survival Guide for Thriving on the World's Most Perilous E-Commerce Platform. Jason, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Doug and Allison. It's a pleasure to be here on Mountain Money. Thanks for having me.
So we mentioned a couple stats about the popularity of its sites and how much commerce goes through it, but give us a sense of Amazon's power. What percentage of U.S. households have Amazon Prime memberships?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I'd like to start with a quote that put in the book, The Amazon Jungle, from Charlie Munger, who's the longtime friend of Warren Buffett and business partner, a real student of U.S. businesses. And the way he describes Amazon is as an utter phenomenon. There's hardly been anything like it in the history of our country. You know, the number of Prime subscribers has topped 150 million. There's about 123 million of those in the United States and growing rapidly. They've seen a nice influx as a result of the COVID crisis, and they've benefited greatly in terms of their Prime membership. So, and if you think about this, Doug, there, you know, my household has two grown adults, my wife and myself. We both use one Prime account. So, the percentages can be a little bit misleading. I would say that the majority of adult buying public in the United States has a Prime account. And I'm one of them. I wrote a book about the truth about Amazon. I'm one of them, right? It's incredibly convenient.
So knowing that there's this many consumers using that one platform, what has been Amazon's overall effect on the 21st century marketplace?
Well, I think this is a once in a generation company. It has completely upended the industries. that it's been involved in. For example, the books industry, that's where it started, right? And I think you can sum up their strategy with a famous quote from Jeff Bezos: "Your margin is my opportunity." And, you know, a friend of mine, Robin Gaster, who's also writing his own Amazon book right now, we have these discussions that are very interesting. If you were to personify Amazon, he would call them a vampire. You know, for Star Trek fans out there, I would call them the Borg, right? Resistance to assimilate is futile, because they go where the opportunity, where the margin is, and they find ways out of efficiencies and technologies to squeeze down the retail prices to the point where consumers, you know, love it. The selection is enormous. The prices are the lowest on the internet. I'm not happy about how they come across those low prices, but, you know, we could talk about that further in discussion.
And we are going to talk about that further in the discussion. But before we go there, I want to share that during the pandemic, currently, my daughter is living in Mexico City. And there's a big difference between there's several, obviously, huge differences between Mexico and the United States. But one of the big differences is Amazon does not have a strong presence here. And what I see when I visit my daughter in Mexico is really a thriving small business community, which reminds me of the United States that I grew up with in the mid-70s to the mid-80s when I was a youngster. The world is very different now. What is the impact on our society? What's the cost to us of losing that thriving small business community?
You know, it's a great question, Doug. It's a real problem. Look, I should say, before I answer that question, I want to tell you about what makes Amazon tick. And there are millions of third-party sellers, we call them 3P sellers or Amazon sellers, that provide the wide selection, the hard work, the product knowledge, the capital, and the grit that allows Amazon to have this extraordinary selection. So there are, you know, about 1.2 million U.S. sellers in the United States who sell on Amazon, not to Amazon. And those are small businesses that have come to rely greatly on Amazon.com for their businesses. I speak out publicly often about the treatment that these third-party sellers get from Amazon. Amazon has put itself in this place as the judge, juror, and executioner to these businesses. If you know, they have the ability to take down a listing, take down your site without any due process, without any real ability or process for that seller to get back up onto Amazon. And if they, you know, so there is a thriving, although terrified, small business community that makes Amazon tick. Amazon wouldn't be what they are today without those small businesses. But back to your point, Doug, it's a problem. You know, the environment that Amazon, we find ourselves with Amazon today, there is no room, period, for the next Amazon to launch and become successful and to catch or do better than Amazon. It just doesn't exist. There's no one out there today with the current environment where Amazon has created this incredible moat on the online business that could come and be the next Amazon. And that's a problem, right? That's a real problem, in my opinion.
So knowing that, you know, these third-party sellers are at the core of Amazon and really helped build the business for them, this is something that you as well were able to start your business being a third-party seller on Amazon. But things have started to change. You talked about the control that Amazon has. They can take the business off the platform. But there's also additional kind of strategies that they use with these third-party sellers that many in the public aren't aware of. Can you give us an insight into that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, the first thing is imagine you have a small brick-and-mortar retail store. And look, there's a lot of small businesses out there today that have experienced this as a result of COVID. Someone comes and boards up your door, right? You're making sales. You have to make payroll for your employees in your store. You have to pay for inventory. You have to keep the lights on. And all of a sudden, someone puts a giant board in front of your door and your store shuts down. So that's one of the biggest things that Amazon does on a regular basis. They will shut down best-selling listings. They will shut down accounts. many times by accident. There are fraudsters out there. There's a small percentage of fraudsters out there that try to take advantage of Amazon. And because there are so many sellers and because the platform is so robust, Amazon creates this artificial intelligence systems to sort of prevent fraud, right? And to prevent bad actors. However, this artificial intelligence, like is often the case, isn't very intelligent and will create these false positives where they will take down well-meaning, hardworking small businesses who are selling and helping the Amazon marketplace thrive. They will take them down without any notice. And it's really, really hard to get back up if you don't know what you're doing. So that's number one. They'll just board up your front, they'll board up your store. Number two, this is one of the most nefarious and sneaky things that I believe Amazon does. It's something called buy box suppression. Doug, if you are selling a product on Amazon and you also decide that you're going to make your product available on Walmart.com, but for a two-week period, you want to give a sale to the Walmart customer that you don't give to the Amazon customer, Amazon will block your listing, essentially killing your listing until you lower your price to match the price that you're offering it on Walmart. So in my opinion, this is one of the sneakiest and nefarious ways, because on Amazon, you don't sell to a human being. You sell to this ranking algorithm. And if all of a sudden your listing is blocked or suppressed because you're giving the Target customer or the Walmart customer a short-term discount, it can really ruin your sales on Amazon. So that's just a couple of the ways that where it's very, it makes it very challenging for the small business. And then the third way really is, and this has become public, the EU has filed charges against Amazon. And there's been, I was actually cited in that House committee report that came out a couple of months ago, showing evidence that Amazon was stealing information, product ideas, et cetera, from these third-party sellers that they were so dependent on, copying the products and offering it for less, which is something that I experienced over my 17 years as a seller.
Okay, so Jason, we're doing a great job of laying out the issue, and then we're going to start talking about some of your suggestions that your book talks about. But before we go there, we've kind of focused on the small business, and I want to make sure our audience understands the issue is even bigger than that. There are large companies that we all use on a daily basis, Netflix, Instagram, Spotify, National Geographic, that are all reliant on Amazon as well. Explain to our listeners what that reliance is.
Well, yeah, this is a great question, Doug. We just experienced this. Amazon has what's called instances. They have these hubs of computing power called the cloud, and Amazon jumped out in front of all of the rest of its competitors, including Microsoft, Google, Oracle, and is in a dominant position for the world of cloud computing. So if you think about, like, when I first started, Doug Nelson, in the e-commerce business, we had machines in a warehouse, right? And then we moved our machines that hosted our website to like the central location. And eventually we moved the hosting of our website onto Amazon Cloud Services because it was cheaper. It was easier to expand and contract our computing power during peak seasons or low seasons, and it was incredibly cost effective. And so what Amazon has done, and they pioneered this, is they have turned computing power into something that would be similar to an electric utility. And so they have these instances across the country, about 25 to 26 different instances where you, for NPR, for example, if you want to host your website, you can use Amazon's cloud services. And there are thousands and thousands of U.S. companies that are using Amazon's cloud services for computer power. There was an instance just in the Southeast that went down recently, and it affected scores of companies, many of which that you just named. But the fascinating part, Doug Nelson, is that was just one instance. And so it goes to show you just how reliant not only small business owners, private label brands have become on Amazon, but also anyone who has a working website, anyone who has a business that has to run through online, many of them are using you know, Amazon.com, AWS for their web services. So in some way, they really have become this public utility. However, the difference between a public utility for electricity and Amazon is Amazon has no accountability. No one is holding them accountable. No one can see what their infrastructure looks like. They are a closed kimono, if you will, and they will not share that information with anyone. And so we have to ask ourselves as a society, is this a good idea for a company as powerful as Amazon, trillion-dollar valuation, who owns everything from, you know, the front door of online products and also the final mile delivery? But in addition, is this a good idea for our small business to be reliant on AWS, Amazon AWS, without any real accountability on behalf of Amazon, right? Is that a good idea? You know, I say this all the time. We cannot become the United States of Amazon, and we are quickly approaching that. You know, their tentacles have literally reached out to every element. And Allison, you did such a great job of highlighting all of the areas where Amazon has been involved in. A new one that just launched is Amazon Pharmacy. So now Amazon's going to start collecting our health data as well. So it really is, again,
the time is now. The time is now to start taking action. Your book talks about that. There was recently a legislative hearing with the big tech companies. Jeff Bezos appeared online to answer the questions of the senators. One of the things that struck me was the deference that the legislators, the deference to the leaders of these tech companies, specifically Amazon, as if they were a little bit of afraid of Amazon themselves, maybe in part because Bezos owns the Washington Post, maybe in part because more Americans have Prime accounts than voted for either a Republican or a Democrat, right?
Right.
So it was the deference that I saw that worried me a little bit. And then sadly, and I mean this with respect, but there's no other way to capture the observation, which is this deference, but also the ignorance of this from our legislative body, which, as you mentioned, Amazon is not a regulated utility. It's really our legislative body's job to understand this and to make sure we have the safeguards in place. Do you share that concern that maybe our legislative body does not understand the significance? And if so, how do we get over that hurdle?
Yeah, and Doug, it's even more than what you pointed out. You're absolutely right. All the reasons you pointed out, I agree with completely. But think about this. Amazon has added nearly half a million jobs since COVID started. In 10 months, they have hired more than 400,000 people. There was a New York Times article that came out recently that said there hasn't been a hiring spree like that since the shipping industry ramped up for shipbuilding during World War II. You have to go all the way back to the early days of the auto industry with Henry Ford hiring to find anything like it. Think about this. All of those jobs are being propped up in every one of those congressional districts, every single one. So it's more than that. The House of Representatives, if you've got an Amazon warehouse coming into your district, do you really want to upset them knowing that you could lose jobs and Amazon could pick up and go to another county who's maybe or another district who are maybe more favorable and more deferential to them? So it's a really big problem. And look, like I beat up Amazon a lot. You know, I've earned a great living as a result of Amazon over the last 20 years and continue to with my agency, Avenue 7 Media. However, you know, Amazon won e-commerce, and now they're spreading their tentacles out in so many other areas. They've done their job. You can't blame them for what they have done. However, the legislators have been asleep at the wheel, not only with Amazon, with a lot of big tech, and it's time for them to step up. There's a couple of different ways that I think you can do this. And, you know, the House is looking at ways to hit a home run and break Amazon up, which I think would be great, right? I actually believe strongly that breaking up Amazon, separating Amazon retail from the third-party marketplace, breaking off AWS, all of those ideas are great pie-in-the-sky ideals. And I think, by the way, Jeff Bezos will become richer. AWS is being constrained in their valuation because it's part of Amazon. I mean, that's how powerful each of these divisions has become. However, I would also be happy to see the legislators hit some singles. You know, I believe that the courts are a great place to change Amazon's behavior. But right now, as a consumer, when you sign up to create an Amazon buying account, you're waiving your rights to sue them. Additionally, Section 230 of the Consumer Decency Act that was, you know, passed back in 1990 protects Amazon from product liability for sellers selling on the platform. So they have no incentive to make sure that product safety requirements are being met before something gets listed and sold on Amazon. Additionally, Amazon has this price-fixing tactic, this buy-box suppression, which prevents sellers from offering a lower price somewhere else. And they're just masking it under this technological way called buy-box suppression. So I would love to see the legislators make it possible. And then, you know, lastly, the third-party sellers. Third-party sellers cannot collaborate in a class-action lawsuit and take Amazon to court to get them to change their behavior, because for the right to sell on the Amazon platform, you have to sign that you're willing to do forced arbitration. So you can't combine powers. You can't combine with a group of other sellers in order to change your behavior. So I think that the legislators need to make it possible and open the doors so that consumers can file lawsuits against Amazon to get them to change their behavior. Sellers can file lawsuits against Amazon collectively in order to get them to change their behavior. There's no way a single seller can compete with the Amazon headquarter buildings that is literally full of lawyers and a legal war chest bigger than anybody. So I think those are some things that has to happen. The legislators have been asleep at the wheel. They need to take action. And again, you know, you mentioned Republicans and Democrats coming together. They agree. They agree that Amazon is a problem. What they can't agree on is what to do about it. And so I'm hopeful that in 2021 they will put their egos aside and take some meaningful action that can help make it possible to improve the lives of consumers, to improve the lives of third-party sellers, and really make it possible for the next Amazon to grow. This is the American way, right? The American dream. And right now, Amazon is blotting the sun.
Great. Well, unfortunately, we need to wrap on that note. Our guest, and Jason, you've done a great job. We really appreciate our conversation this morning. Our guest has been Jason Boyce, author of The Amazon Jungle, The Truth About Amazon, The Seller's Survival Guide for Thriving on the World's Most Perilous E-Commerce Marketplace. Jason, I really wish we had more time, but we need to wrap. Hopefully sometime in the future we can have you again. And audience, please stay tuned. Mountain Money will be back after this.
Welcome back to KPCW's Mountain Money. While the traditional value chain companies that dominated the 20th century are fading, platforms and digital ecosystems are red-hot business models that have driven stock markets to new heights. Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Alphabet now make up 30% of the S&P. These big tech platforms companies claimed that they would make the world a better place, yet consumers and regulators are increasingly frustrated with them. Eric Jakimisthaler is author of The Interaction Field, the revolutionary new way to create shared value for business, customers, and society, and joins us this morning on Mountain Money. Eric, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
So you've been a thought leader on brand strategy, innovation, and marketing for over 30 years. How did you come to develop this interaction field concept?
I years ago started to realize that what really drives all those new technology innovations, whether it's machine learning, which is cloud computing, is the internet, is social media, has to do with one thing. Everything connects. People connect, companies connect, things connect. And this hyper-connectivity globally at any time of the day really drives an entirely new business model, an entire new way of building brands and creating companies. And we have seen this happening, and that's what sort of started me to think about the interaction theory concept.
So let's lay the groundwork for our audience. we're all familiar with the term ecosystem. It's, you know, people that are interconnected in the same business. Maybe it's a supplier, maybe it's somebody that does the infrastructure for the business, and then it's somebody that sells to the consumer. It's an ecosystem. There's also platform companies that would be folks like Amazon. Our previous guest talked about Amazon or eBay. But you use the term interaction fields. Explain to us what you mean by that term.
Yeah, to me, interaction fields is the next evolution from platforms and digital ecosystems. And the reasons why that is the case is that platforms, you know, think of Uber or think of an example, or Airbnb, or as you said, just said Amazon, basically are two-sided marketplaces that brings together sellers, third-party sellers in this case with Amazon, and consumers, and make a money and make a fee, make a money on fees. Digital ecosystems then is the next evolution. Airbnb is an example. On one side, they bring together travelers. On one side, and the other side, they bring together people who have an apartment, let's say in New York, and they match those two. And then they build an ecosystem around it in order to make that share, that apartment rental, if you will, make it more efficient. There are cleaning services, a host of other services. And they're all, but what these two models that we just talked about are still all about is they are basically self-serving. They are basically just economic entities to make more money and to be more profitable and serve a particular need. Interaction fields are very different. Interaction fields are there to solve much bigger problems than just, let's say, getting a room in an apartment in New York, let's say. Interaction fields are there to solve real problems, not only from a consumer level, but also at the industry level or at the more societal level.
So knowing that, you know, as I stated in the introduction, many people are questioning the benefit of these types of organizations, but with your thoughts on interaction fields, you feel like this could provide, or it creates value for everyone. So could you give us an example of a company that falls into this and how they create the shared value?
There are many examples. So in my book, I actually looked at every industry, every category, a major category in a business, from automotive to agriculture to healthcare to luxury goods to, of course, the retail business. And in each one of these, you see now these new types of business models to emerge. Think of the agricultural field. I think we all know very well. John Deere sells tractors. You know, it sells very expensive tractors and very high-quality tractors. But the value that John Deere creates is no longer just in selling a very, very great technology tractor. What John Deere also does is it collects data and information from the agricultural field. And in the old days, in the platform world and the digital ecosystem world, John Deere would hoard those information and then would try to sell more tractors, let's say. What's different in the interaction field model is that John Deere, actually it's called myjohndeere.com, John Deere, an open platform, John Deere aggregates those data from hundreds of thousands of farmers. It aggregates data about the irrigation of the plant, of the field, the soil condition of the field, the profitability even of the farm. And taking those data together, John Deere shares those data with other farmers so that farmers can learn from farmers and actually improve the productivity and of the field and the profitability of the farm. And here is why it becomes an interaction field company. It also shares the data with fertilizer companies like Bayer, or previously called Monsanto, Syngenta, or with crop companies that help to make sure that the agricultural field becomes more profitable and for farmers. So this is not like another form of competition like platforms do. You know, Uber competes against taxis. Airbnb competes against all the hotel companies or Booking.com. This is not a form of competition. This is a form of collaboration so that everybody wins. That's what I mean by shared value.
It's collaboration within the supply chain is what I hear you saying. So it's vertical collaboration as opposed to horizontal with competitors. And it makes a lot of sense. The more profitable a farmer is, right? If the fertilizer company knows more about a farm field, if the service people, if the irrigation people know more about a farm, the farmer's more profitable. He or she has more money to buy a more expensive, a more advanced John Deere tractor. So everybody wins. It makes sense, but it kind of, at least, it goes a little bit against American culture, right? Americans are very independent. Now, I'm learning Spanish, and I have an American accent when I speak Spanish with somebody. You have an accent, so I'm guessing you grew up in a different country. What is your take on what I just said, that it might be more difficult to do something like this in America because of our independence? Do you agree with that? And is there a country that's doing it well now?
Yes, I do. I do think that there are countries who are a bit ahead of this. And I think it works really well in America as well. And I know the American spirit. I love America. I came from Germany originally and spent most of my time, 25 years in Latin America. But I know the U.S. very well. And yes, there is the American spirit. But especially in this day and age, the pandemic world, especially in the last couple of years, and especially through this pandemic world, American companies realize that nobody does it alone. Solving the major problems we have in industry after industry, whether it's reducing healthcare or reducing highway deaths, in the car industry, or reducing our gas emissions, if you will, the CO2 emissions, it requires more than just pushing products and competing. I think American companies are realizing that the basic fundamental model of competition has run its course. We've got to think about collaboration, participation, and engagement. This is where value is created today. And to your question, what countries are sort of ahead of it? I really look with great admiration to China. China has an Alibaba. They don't have Amazon, but they have an Alibaba. But Alibaba doesn't destruct categories in industry, doesn't disrupt industries. Now, lately, the pharmaceutical industries starting with the book industry. Alibaba, as an example, is actually building entire industries, building, if you will, what I call the digital Silk Road from many, many years before. So China is actually a very good example, or some Asian countries that are actually have a major run on American companies right now, and they are coming.
So when you talk about the interaction field, and you gave the example of John Deere and talking about including the fertilizer companies or those that make seeds, from that, when you talk about the interaction fields, one of those pieces or one of the players could also be government. So when you think about automobiles, you can think about the Department of Transportation. So this isn't necessarily, you know, just with private companies. This is greater than that.
Yeah. So this is really important. I love your question, because when you think of an Uber, they think of the government as the enemy. They think about, you know, we need to change the regulation of the government in order to enable Uber drivers in New York City. In the traditional way of thinking of platforms and ecosystems, the government is sort of an external source of evil, or sort of that hinders the competition. When you think of an interaction field, then you make the government part of the value creation. When you think about it, where is the majority of subsidies going It's going from the government to subsidize farmers. And why would the government have to do that? It's because we need a food supply that is critical. 40 million Americans still are not getting enough food on the table in this country alone. So think about this, the global problem we have in world hunger. So the government subsidizes farmers. If the government is part of the solution, the government, in this case, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they are part of the interaction field, and actually solve together with companies like the fertilizer company or crop companies or the John Deere companies or others that serve the farmers and solve for the real problems we have. And maybe with a lot of less subsidies and a lot more profits for farmers at the end.
Okay, let's keep going on this. One of the things that I really love about your explanation of the interaction field is the creation of value. Right, the farmer becomes more profitable. We've created value from knowledge, essentially, by the sharing of knowledge and by the cooperation. I want to expand this outside of farming, though. You mentioned the food scarcity. I would argue that's not a problem of growing crops. That's a problem much larger than that. It's distribution. It's store location, stuff like that. But let's go outside of agriculture and explore this concept of groups working together to create value. Give us another example of an industry where that can be done.
Yeah. Let's look at one very complex industry, healthcare. Healthcare, you have very sensitive privacy data, right? And everybody sort of, and it's a difficult thing. 18 million Americans are every year, 18 million Americans are diagnosed with cancer. And every hospital and every doctor has sort of a way of solving cancer with some form of a drug, one from Pfizer called Avastin, one from Roche and so forth and so forth. Every major pharmaceutical company has a huge drug business. And guess what they do is they hire pharmaceutical detailed salespeople that have in 15-minute intervals meetings with doctors to convince the doctors that they should prescribe this drug over that drug. That's the old system. Now enter then in the action field. There's a company called Flatiron Health. They're actually around here in New York City and close to our offices here. Flatiron Health collects from hospitals, from doctors, they collect very detailed data about the treatment of patients. And because doctors are not willing to provide those data that easily, and because doctors scribble something and mumble something when they diagnose a patient, so Flatiron Health has hired what's called an abstract, with hourly employees that follow the doctor, and everything the doctor says, they scribble down on a piece of paper, on a digital record. That is now shared there are 1.8 million, so about 10%, 15% actually, 2.5 million patients that provide those data, 2,500 cancer hospitals that provide data, and doctors that provide data now to Flatiron Health aggregates those data, that those interactions that take place on a daily basis and are treating patients across this country, and then shares those data not only with the pharmaceutical companies, all of them, but also other ways of dealing with therapies, eating therapies and things like that. And what happens, and of course with the department, with the FDA that approves drugs. And here's what has happened is that now we have found after several years of this work is that many times when you are diagnosed with a drug, you don't actually need a drug. Sometimes you don't need a drug at all. So you can actually avoid some very, very health therapies that cause you a lot of problems. Number two, we have found that sometimes a combination of drugs, competitors actually working together. So Roche works together with Pfizer in order to come up with a combination that is less harmful to the health of the patient and actually treats cancer. And most importantly, the FDA has now allowed faster approval of drugs. So some of the drugs that actually were not available for some patients are now already available to patients based on RWE, real-world evidence data from Flatiron Health. So everybody benefits. Actual cancer patients who have an 18-month time window of living actually get on this system and actually get treated in time so that they can actually save their lives. The pharmaceutical companies benefit, the hospitals benefit, the patients benefit, the doctors benefit, they learn from each other, the FDA, the government benefits, we have less of a health crisis, everyone benefits. And this is an example in cancer and should be adopted in every other part of healthcare.
So the way that you're describing interaction fields, it definitely sounds like this is a way to make the world a better place. And not just that, but the efficiencies that you're starting to describe from this interaction from multiple different types of parties or different angles of a problem really show how people can work better together. What is we as consumers, what can we do to help encourage this type of business model to grow and flourish?
Thank you so much for that question, because here's what happens. I'm a marketing, I'm a brand person, I'm a business person. What I have found is that this is the first time that consumers are not just the recipient of a product or service. You know, it's not the first time that we are not selling something to the consumers or customers. We actually make them active part of the value creation. The farmers sharing data, they are part of value creation. The patients that are willing to provide their records, their health records, the doctors that are willing to share their experiences with other doctors across the country, they are actual part of value creation. That is why that is so significant. In the old days, the value was created in a factory, in the supply chain, and we were pushing out a product. And every product was supposed to be different and better and faster and whatever. And that model has run its course. The new model is creating shared value and by actually making everyone a participant in the action field. So the role of consumers and customers is fundamentally changing. We all have a stake at it. That happens in the automotive industry when you drive away a Tesla. That happens in the agricultural field when you drive a tractor, whether it's a John Deere tractor or not. And it happens in hospitals when you are a patient and on some sort of therapy.
Well, Allison, thanks for asking that question. That's a great note for us to wrap up with. Our guest this morning has been Eric Joachim Thaler, and he is the author of The Interaction Field, The Revolutionary New Way to Create Shared Value for Business, Customers, and Society. Eric, thank you for joining us. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Well, the last two guests, we gave a bit of a long introduction to let you know who they are. Our next guest does not need a long introduction. He is Seth Adams. We've all been to his restaurant. We've all heard him on the radio supporting KPCW. And Seth's group, the River Horse Group, is opening a new eatery in Prospector Square called the Salt Box. Seth, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
So we're all familiar with the River House. Talk to us about your new location, the Salt Box.
Well, you know, we wanted to, you know, give our catering department kind of its own identity. You know, when people think about River Horse, they sort of probably think it's expensive. So we didn't want to have that, you know, people to think that about our catering division, because we can do virtually anything. So we wanted to give it its own brand. So we stuck it over there in Prospector Square, where we've got lots of parking and easy load in, load out. And, you know, there's a small cafe in the front of it where you can get coffee, espresso, juices, smoothies, you know, on a very small menu and a little seating. So kind of a cozy little spot right over there, but primarily just to help us, you know, expand outside the four walls of the River Horse.
You know, I think that's really smart. Regular listeners of the show know I'm a little bit frugal. And you're right. River Horse is associated with an excellent meal. It's also associated with a little bit more pricey meal than other places. So that's a, a great idea. And Saltbox is that brand. I think a lot of folks may not be familiar with your catering business. So tell us a little bit about your catering business.
Well, you know, we can do anything from, you know, drop it off at your house to come inside and, you know, have a chef prepare a meal for you. So we can cover a large range of any kind of event. We do weddings down in Midway at some of those ranches down there. We do things in homes, you know, and then we, you know, we'll just drop off food to people also. So, you know, we can do virtually anything.
So knowing that, so, you know, you've just launched Saltbox, and one thing that you did say is you wanted a way to be able to highlight the catering service, but many may be looking at the current economic conditions wondering, this was a large kind of venture to begin with. Was this something that you had on the plate? How long had you been thinking about this, and were you biting your nails thinking about opening this this fall?
Yeah, absolutely. It was terrible timing. We were, you know, trying to get open in March, honestly, and that's right when, you know, we all got shut down. So then that put everything on hold. And then as we kind of tried to get back going and contractors going, we kind of missed the summer window. But, you know, we were still catering at that point anyway. So we're trying to get catering going. So, and, you know, we use the catering kitchen over there at Saltbox to help us produce some of the stuff that we sell at Provisions as well. So we've been utilizing the kitchen for several months. And then, honestly, a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh, my gosh, it's almost Thanksgiving. We need to open. So we just kind of opened the doors and have been selling espresso and coffee and some other things, but we didn't really tell anyone we were over there. So now is about time we get the word out and, you know, get people to stop by and grab a croissant and a cup of coffee on their way up the hill, or, you know, to go skiing in the morning or on their way to work. So,
well, hopefully we're helping you do just that, get the word out. So mm-hmm. far, I know coffee, I know croissants, I know smoothies. What other types of food are you offering?
Sandwiches, wraps. You know, we have a small menu with some bison, you know, an egg sandwich. We actually have the same Provisions breakfast. The breakfast wrap that we sell Provisions, we're offering over there as well because it's so good. We said, why not? Well, why reinvent the wheel? Let's just sell that one over there too. So you don't always have to go up the main street to get our Provisions wrap. But yeah, I mean, it was weird timing, but you know, it's worked out well for us. And you know, I'm sure because of the circumstances, the catering will be a big thing this winter. So we're excited to, you know, get out and be, you know, offering something other than just coming to the Riverwars for your anniversary or whatnot. But we're happy to have people here too.
So any people are familiar with that location. It was the home to Off Main Cafe, Good Karma. And one of the benefits that place had was a phenomenal outdoor dining seating area. And knowing that you're not doing kind of a serviced meal, is that something that you're going to bring back in the spring and summer?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm working with the homeowners association over there to potentially expand our patio back there for next summer. So we will next, you know, in the spring and summer be offering outdoor dining and, you know, kind of an expanded menu for the summertime.
So, Seth, obviously this is a difficult time for our city. It's a difficult time for all restaurant owners. And we're all in this together, obviously. And some level, you're competing with the other restaurateurs. But I'm interested in your thoughts. What have you found to be useful, to be helpful as a restaurant owner to help you survive through this period?
I mean, you know, I think a lot of people locally were coming out and trying to support us, you know, when we were able to reopen. And that's been a huge, you know, so many familiar faces, you know, even if I'm not in the restaurant and I look at the reservations and I see people coming through, you know, that's been one of our biggest strong points. And, you know, we all know there's a lot of people in town. So that's been a big help for us to, you know, get through this, you know, difficult time. And, you know, we were able to retain most of our staff. So we, you know, we kind of hit the ground running when we got back open. And, you know, I think we're just fortunate that, you know, everyone did come out and, you know, support us and supported Provisions or got curbside. And, you know, we're still doing plenty of to-go orders at the River Wars nightly. So, you know, it's, you know, I think all in this together is what you said. It hits it on the head. You know, we've all you know, trying to help each other and support each other. And I've seen that even, you know, with my neighbors and other friends not in the business coming out and ordering Thanksgiving dinners and all kinds of stuff. So it's been great.
I'm glad to hear that you've seen that local support. As you look forward to this winter season, how are you preparing for staffing and hours of operation? Are you going to be operating all three locations 7 days a week, or how are you breaking this down?
Yeah, we're planning on doing all three locations 7 days a week. So, you know, Provisions opens at 8 a.m. and closes at, you know, 6 or 7, depending on, you know, the to-go orders and the pickups going on. So they're kind of flexible, and Saltbox will be kind of the same as we get into the winter with hopefully the pickup items for catering and or take home to, you know, feed your family. So, and then River Horse is business as usual. We, on the Christmas days, we actually are opening up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, just to try to get some of the early families in there that want to have dinner early and get out, or, you know, get home and celebrate Christmas. So,
will you be putting together a meal package for Christmas or even New Year's?
Yes, we have both. So, and then we're offering a holiday or Christmas, New Year's Eve drop-off for New Year's, a drop-off menu. So we'll bring it to your house. You can order it for two, you can order it for 15, and we'll bring it to you and drop it off. So,
as you said,
we're doing that.
That's great. And as you said, you've received a lot of support from the locals, and knowing that the winter season is critical for many businesses, restaurants especially, how can the locals continue to support you?
I mean, come to Main Street, you know, because whether you're buying a shirt on Main Street and then you're hungry, you're going to one of the restaurants or bars or something. So, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, is keep it coming, and, you know, we'll do our best to give you a memorable dining experience no matter where you're at. And, you know, we've got our fingers crossed that it snows. And, you know, we have, you know, people coming to ski and enjoy the restaurants safely and, you know, wearing a mask. So.
And finally, how can our listeners find Saltbox and your other restaurants?
So RiverHorseParkCity.com, RiverHorseProvisions.com, and SaltboxTC.com. Are the three there now.
Perfect.
And, you know, we can always online, and you can submit an inquiry, and one of our sales team will get back to you and, you know, get whatever you need on the books for us. So.
Sounds great. Well, we've been talking with Seth Adams. He has been talking with us about the new eatery, which is called Saltbox, located in Prospector Square. You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.